In this segment, we will discuss some of the limitations of evidence-based medicine. What are some of these limitations? Well, one author has written, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, that evidence-based medicine is a, quote, system of belief that requires prospectively collected objective evidence of everything except its own utility. And in fact, another author has pointed out that there really is no evidence that evidence-based medicine itself is evidence-based. That is, that by applying principles of evidence-based medicine that we have better care. Of course, it may be hard to prove that, but nonetheless, it's something that should probably be looked at. There have always been concerns about the value of evidence-based medicine for individual patients. For example, when we talked about randomized controlled trials, we noted that people are often excluded when they have the very conditions, the complicated comorbid conditions, for whom the results of the clinical trial will be applied. So if we exclude patients, we run the risk that the results of the clinical trial won't directly apply to the patient. Cohen and colleagues wrote a paper that attempted to categorize the various criticisms of evidence-based medicine. The major categories that they came up with were as follows. First, evidence-based medicine is based mainly on empiricism, that is, on empirical experiments. And of course, this is inadequate because there are other ways that we gain knowledge, such as through experience and observation. Another category is that the definition of EBM is narrow, and it excludes things that are important to clinicians. Cohen et al. Also noted that EBM itself is not evidence-based. That is, there isn't good evidence to show that this approach necessarily results in better health. They also noted that sometimes EBM is limited in how well it applies to particular patients, such as patients with multiple illnesses or elderly patients or any other group of patients that doesn't frequently get included in randomized controlled trials. Finally, there is the threat to the autonomy of the clinician-patient relationship. The EBM approach has specific results from studies, but in reality, clinicians or patients may have differing preferences. And so a pure, by-the-book EBM approach threatens the autonomy of that relationship. So let's talk a little bit about empiricism. So empiricism is the belief that scientific observations can be made independent of biases of the observer. So essentially, we should only trust things that we can study and measure. And empirical observation, so things like randomized controlled trials and observational studies, is really only one form of scientific observation. And for example, there may be instances where it makes sense to use reasoning of what we know from pathophysiologic principles, or to do more qualitative analyses on aspects of clinical care that are beneficial and harmful to the patient. So randomized controlled trials do eliminate some forms of bias, but they may introduce others. And for example, randomized controlled trials really only allow us to assess things that can be measured, the old adage that only measurable things are measured. So the empirical view of science may not be enough to truly come up with a comprehensive approach to healthcare. So there's this ongoing concern that evidence-based medicine may threaten the autonomy of the clinician-patient relationship. Sometimes the autonomy, the decision-making that a patient and their clinician make is a very personal thing. But, of course, other times we know that it should be better based on science, and we also know that there should be some accountability in terms of the resources used. But nonetheless, we've seen examples where the best evidence may not apply to all patients. And we also note that readers of the scientific literature, according to Ted Kapchuk, an advocate for alternative medicine, don't begin with a blank slate, but rather they bring their own biases, and that is a kind of a priori view that they bring to the literature, which the results of studies may or may not change their minds. There are some other challenges to the evidence-based approach. Eric Larson, an insightful internist, has noted the following. First of all, many evidence-based analyses don't take cost into consideration. They focus solely on the evidence. Some evidence-based approaches ignore things like individual preference and variability. And there are regional differences in practice that have been documented by people like John Wenberg, but there may be reasons for those variations that are based on preferences. We also have other factors that drive patient preferences, some not so good, such as direct-to-consumer marketing and so forth. But we have patients who desire things like alternative medicine, and we should probably take their desires at least somewhat into account. And, of course, we see the selective use of evidence when people have a specific interest. So when you have an insurance company that doesn't want to cover something, they may selectively use the evidence to say, we're not going to cover this because there's no evidence that it's beneficial. That may actually be the appropriate approach, but are they also willing to cover something when the evidence is there? Likewise, we occasionally see selective use of evidence by authors of papers, including those who are describing trials funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Even patients have their views and selective use of evidence. So one idea that has been taking hold is the notion of moving from evidence-based medicine to evidence-based practice. How do we distinguish these? Well, the notion of evidence-based practice is how effectively we can apply evidence-based medicine in our actual medical practice. And a statement was published by Dawes and many associates that laid out the tenets of evidence-based practice, and a lot of it focuses on measuring and improving quality, and the whole evidence base for quality is assessed by Shojania in the paper I cite here. So one notion of moving from evidence-based medicine to evidence-based practice is closing the care gaps. And this figure was pointed out to me by OHSU faculty Dr. David Doerr and comes from a paper by Oliveria et al. That looks at physicians' awareness of the JNC6 guidelines for treating blood pressure. And many physicians are aware of them. Many of them purport to follow them, but when you ask if they're satisfied with blood pressure control on a given patient, and perhaps even more importantly, when that patient comes in and is either in good blood pressure control or not, you have this care gap. So we know all the evidence about the value of treating hypertension, high blood pressure, and it's reducing risk of various cardiovascular complications. But we need to close this care gap, and we can think of that as an instance of evidence-based practice, of not only knowing the right evidence-based medicine tests and treatments and so forth, but actually applying them in our practices. Another challenge to evidence-based medicine is whether we should focus on improving the efficacy of treatments or
expanding access to treatments that we already have. This is demonstrated in this figure from this paper by Wolf. And this analysis looks at a drug, for example, that reduces mortality by 20%. So its relative risk reduction is 20%. And there are 100,000 people, let's say, we could give the drug to, and 20,000 of those people will benefit. Now, if the number of people who have access to that drug is less than the full amount, perhaps because they don't have health insurance, then there will be a gap. And instead of averting 20,000 deaths, we may only avert 16,000 if only 80% of the population has access to the drug. If we do that, in order to achieve the same benefit with a new drug that only has 80% access, we would have to develop a drug that has a 25% risk reduction to make up for the fact that 4,000 people are not getting it. If there's only 60% access, that would be 8,000 lives not being saved, and the relative risk reduction needed would go up to over 33%. The point of this figure is to demonstrate that another way to improve overall benefit to society from a treatment is to make sure that everyone gets access to it, which of course gets back to a major problem in the United States and other countries of not everyone having full access to health care.
So where do we go with evidence-based medicine? I've taken you on a whirlwind tour in this unit of issues on how to evaluate tests, treatments, guidelines, systematic reviews, and so forth. Where do we want to head with evidence-based medicine? What's its relationship to informatics? Brian Haynes, one of the founding fathers, if you will, of evidence-based medicine, has recognized some of the limitations and argues that EBM must evolve and find its place in healthcare and the larger healthcare picture. Timmermans also looks at how successful or unsuccessful EBM has been in terms of improving healthcare. Well, let me close by giving you my view, and then in our discussion, we can talk about your views. So my view, which probably is not limited to evidence-based medicine, but anything in terms of evaluating data, making opinions, particularly scientific opinions, is that one cannot be too dogmatic about anything. And I suppose this applies to informatics as well. One cannot be so dogmatic that you'll not take into account new information, be able to change your mind. So we have to have a little bit of skepticism, a little bit of open-mindedness, or hopefully a lot of open-mindedness, but the ability to change our thinking. So I like to think of this as enlightened skepticism. I'm skeptical about many things, but you can't be too skeptical. On the other hand, that puts you in the camp of, again, not thinking. So being enlightened with your skepticism, of keeping an open mind, willing to consider new ideas, but also putting information to the test. Is there evidence to support this? So I look forward to hearing your views on this as well.